case you don't recognize it, what we're looking at here is a breast, which could also be called a mamma, M-A-M-M-A, plural of which is mammy. So there are two mammy on a normal woman. Sometimes, colloquially, breasts are called mammary glands. That's actually a misnomer because the mammary glands, the actual glands that produce milk, are usually hardly there at all because usually lactation is not occurring. And therefore, the mammary glands contribute almost nothing to the bulk of the breast. As you see here, most of the breast in a non-lactating woman is made up of fat in adipose tissue. So you can see that in the cutaway view here. It's not that there aren't any mammary glands in there, it's just that they are in a suspended state and haven't increased in size yet, and they haven't started actually producing the milk, which is what lactation is. So lactation doesn't refer to the ejection of the milk. Lactation refers to actually producing the milk within the glands and storing it until it needs to be ejected by in response to a suckling infant during nursing. And those actually are under hormonal control by separate hormones. What is the hormone that actually stimulates the mammary glands within the breast to start lactating?
Prolactin,
because it promotes lactation. That's why it's called that. So that produces the milk. And then what is the hormone that responds to the suckling of the nipple by the infant to actually release the milk that's already been produced? Oxytocin, right. So oxytocin does double duty in the female reproductive system, right? It's for ejection of the milk, but what else is it for? Parturition, right. Oxytocin responds, the uterus responds to oxytocin by undergoing contraction, which is what forces the fetus out, in which case we change its name to a baby. Okay, but back to the breast. On the left side of the picture, we see a lactating breast. And so, if the breast is lactating, first of all, it's larger, but not the increase in size is not a doubling of size or more, right? It's a noticeable size increase, but like I said, most of the size to begin with was because of fat in the adipose tissue. The additional volume that occurs, though, in a lactating breast is because those mammary glands have been spurred on to develop, become much larger, and start producing the milk. And that's what we see in pink here. The mammary glands are arranged into lobes, as you see, and each lobe is arranged in turn into smaller subdivisions called lobules. Now, the lobules contain cells that are secretory. This is a gland, after all. What kind of gland is it functionally? What kind of gland is it? Does it qualify? It's an exocrine gland, right, because it's releasing its secretory product through a duct, right? So each of these lobes collects the milk that's produced by the cells making up the lobules into what is called a lactiferous duct. And several lactiferous ducts converge into bigger ones. But there's not just one outlet at the nipple. So there are several lactiferous ducts that empty onto the surface of the nipple, which means that milk emerges from the nipple in more than one orifice. There's several different holes on the nipple. By the way, the nipple is surrounded by the areola, which is usually a darker ring around the nipple. Both the nipple and the areola are darker than the surrounding skin because of closeness of blood vessels to the surface in that area. Why is it that these things are darker in color? I mean, evolutionarily, why is that true? What is it? Right, it's a bullseye for the baby, which doesn't have all that good a vision yet to be able to see where to latch on to. Okay, let's go to 8. By the way, there's three major kinds of mammals. Anyone know what the three are? Well, we are eutherians. That's one kind of mammal. Marsupials is one, is the second kind. And the third kind are monotremes, which there's almost none of species-wise. Duck-billed platypus and echidnas are monotremes. They're the most primitive of the mammals. Well, marsupials and eutherians both have nipples. All mammals, they're named mammals for the fact that they produce milk. They have mammy, in other words. But monotremes don't actually have nipples, though. So the mother, like a duck-billed platypus, for instance, or an echidna, produce milk and then just kind of seep it through the skin like sweat, not release it in one point like the nipple. So the young just lap it off the skin wherever, rather than having to latch onto a nipple. Anyway, let's go back to humans. So slide 8, and notice the two-sidedness of this. I say that because the left side does not match up perfectly with the right side in terms of time, except for the major subdivisions that you see. So at the very top, notice we have before birth. The left side of this whole thing describes, as you see, development of the egg, which is oogenesis. Oo means egg. An egg can be called an egg. It can be called an ovum. It can be called an egg cell. They all mean the same thing. But egg cells go through a development phase. And therefore, we can talk about different stages of that egg development and call an oocyte, which is just another name for an egg, either a primary or a secondary oocyte, depending on which stage of development the egg cell is in. Well, that's what's happening on the left side. Okay? Confusingly, there are primary oocytes and secondary oocytes. And oocytes are contained within a group of cells that surround them, collectively called a follicle. And we use primary and secondary and tertiary and mature to refer to follicular development. But the word primary or secondary as applied to an oocyte does not correspond to primary or secondary for the follicle. That's what's confusing about this, all right? So what makes the distinction about whether an oocyte is primary or secondary is where it is in meiosis. Now, this is happening totally different from how it is in a male. In male, meiosis starts and starts, continues uninterrupted, and ends very soon. You know, and it happens every day, produces millions and hundreds of millions of sperm every day, fresh from the start, from a beginning cell. But in a female, the process starts before she's born, pauses for decades in some cases, and then resumes. All right. So the primary oocytes, that's the first stage of the egg development. These primary oocytes are called primary oocytes because they have not yet completed meiosis I. Meiosis occurs in two stages, remember. All right. Well, meiosis actually starts before the female is born, while she is still a fetus. But then it pauses. And it pauses for at least 14 years or so, because 14 is the average age of the first menstrual cycle, first ovulation. I mean, it depends on from person to person and from country to country, but nowadays it's roughly 14 as an average. So that's the minimum time for which it pauses. But some eggs, you know, only certain eggs get chosen to be ovulated. So some eggs pause for 50 years before they're actually resumed to continue their meiosis. Okay? So whenever that occurs, meiosis one, once it's completed and then therefore produces two things, that's when we call the egg a secondary oocyte rather than primary. It's completed meiosis one. And that happens right before ovulation. But I've talked a little bit before about the fact that females want to make as big a gamete as possible, right? So when meiosis one gets completed, instead of making two equal sized things like you would make in a male, you make one big one, which becomes the secondary oocyte, and the other one is just big enough to get rid of that extra DNA. It's called a polar body, a first polar body, because it's produced by meiosis one, and that just degenerates, gets recycled. Okay, well, that happens, by the time that happens, by the time we rename the primary oocyte the secondary oocyte, which has already completed meiosis one, it is in a follicle that has gone through primary, secondary, and tertiary stages. That's what's confusing. Okay, so when we use the word primary, secondary, or tertiary to apply to a follicle, we care about really what's happening in the follicle, not the egg that it contains. So in the ovary of a fetus before it's born are millions of primordial follicles, the earliest stage in follicular development. And a primordial follicle is defined that way because it contains a primary oocyte and just a single layer of squamous epithelial cells surrounding it. Those epithelial cells, as you see, are called follicular cells. Primordial follicles they develop from what are called oogonia. But before that female is born, all of the oogonia become primordial follicles. Okay, there are millions of those, most of which will die before she's born, leaving just a couple million primordial follicles at birth. Most of those primordial follicles will die before she reaches puberty. So before she uses any of them, most of those will die, leaving only a couple hundred thousand, which is still way more than she's going to need for a lifetime because of another major difference. Instead of making millions of gametes every day, a female making and releasing millions per day, a female releases only, on average, one egg per month, per 28 days, which is the average for the sexual cycle. Okay, and that can vary also from person to person. It can be shorter or longer than 28, but that's an average. So that, and she does this for roughly 30, 35 years of fertility, right? From about 14 to about 50, call it 35 years. Well, how many months is 35 years? It's only a little over 400 months. So she only needs 400 eggs, really. 200,000 is way more than she needs, even though she's lost millions to get down to 200,000. Well, most of those 200,000 also are going to die as well, because they get chosen in groups to be the ones that are among the thousands that are still remaining. 20 or so, between 20 and 30 of those at a time, each month or each 28 days, get chosen to be a class or a cohort of cells that get spurred on to continue their development. And each of those cohorts is going to actually have one that will become the dominant follicle. The rest of them will die. So only one, if you think of it as a class that graduates, only one member graduates from each class and the rest die. Okay, so This is showing you the stage for the one that's lucky enough to graduate. It goes through all the stages. It starts as primordial follicle, though, and it becomes a primary follicle sometime. This could be the first sexual cycle that the female has at puberty, or it could be the last one she has right before menopause. Sometime, though, after adolescence, a primordial follicle will be developed into a primary follicle. Primary follicle still contains a primary oocyte. But what makes it a primary rather than primordial follicle is that the cells that line it, the follicular cells, as they used to be called, develop into cuboidal cells rather than squamous, and they are now renamed as granulosa cells. All right? The next stage in that development, and this is driven by hormones as they get secreted and build up, would be the secondary follicle, which is defined really by a buildup of granulosa cells into several layers, and the development of a covering made up of cells collectively called the theca folliculi, which means the box of the felic, of the follicle. Kind of an outer covering. All right, and then further development will turn that secondary follicle into a tertiary follicle. Now this still, the egg that's in here, is still a primary oocyte. But the follicle at this point is tertiary when the granulosa cells that have been accumulating start secreting a bunch of fluid. So instead of just seeing cells packed against the oocyte, you have a fluid-filled space called the antrum. And that's what really defines the tertiary follicle. This is getting, and notice the follicle is getting bigger and bigger. So the follicles get actually enormous. They get the size of the ovary itself, actually, by the time they ovulate. The rest of them are much smaller, of course, left behind. But a tertiary follicle then develops into a Graafian follicle, or a mature follicle, as I said. That's right before ovulation occurs. And that is when meiosis I, finally, after maybe up to 50 years of pausing, gets completed. And that primary oocyte becomes two cells, one of which is the secondary oocyte, which saves most of the cytoplasm for itself, and then the first polar body is the other thing that gets wasted. Okay, so in the mature or Graafian follicle is where you have the secondary oocyte. And ovulation comes very soon thereafter, which is an eruption of the egg from that follicle through the tunica albuginea, which is the outer surface of the ovary itself, remember. Well, the egg itself, notice, is within the overall follicle, is surrounded by its own group of cells, which are called the cumulus oophorus. And during ovulation, both the secondary oocyte and its cumulus oophorus get released. The rest of what was called the follicle, the Graafian follicle, or mature follicle, stays behind. But it's not just broken down for raw material. What's left behind after the egg is removed from the follicle is still a useful device. It's an endocrine structure. And it gets a name change. It's no longer called a follicle at this point, because by definition a follicle contains an oocyte. The oocyte has already been ovulated. At this point, though, what's left of the follicle is now called the corpus luteum, which means yellow body, because of a buildup of lipids that makes it look yellowish. And the corpus luteum, as I said, is endocrine in nature, meaning it's going to secrete important hormones that we'll look at in a second. For a while only, though. So the corpus luteum has a window of opportunity to release its hormones, which will prepare the uterine lining or it will maintain the uterine lining in a state that is ready for pregnancy. All right? Which is why the timing is good, because you can't have pregnancy until the egg is released. So right after ovulation, the corpus luteum, which is left behind, will keep the uterus in just the right condition for implantation of a zygote and development into an embryo. All right? That's pregnancy. If that doesn't happen, though, then the uterine lining will start sloughing off, which is what menstruation is. And that happens, though, because the hormones being released by the corpus luteum will no longer be released after the corpus luteum dies or undergoes involution. So it's the death of the corpus luteum that actually tells the body, tells the uterus, pregnancy didn't occur. Therefore, no need to maintain this thick endometrium of the uterus. There's nothing to implant. So just get rid of it. Get rid of that material as menstrual fluid. All right? Now, in the case of pregnancy, the corpus luteum still dies. But a different structure takes over the job of producing the hormones that were coming from the corpus luteum. Anyone know what that other structure is? That you would have only if pregnancy occurs. That's the placenta, which is tissue that is half the property of the mother and half the property of the developing embryo. It's a sharing of tissue, actually. Well, that takes over the job of producing the hormones required to keep that tissue, that endometrial tissue of the uterus, thick and nutritive. And therefore, when the corpus luteum dies, in the case of pregnancy, it doesn't matter. Okay, slide 9. Well, these are just photomicrographs, histological photomicrographs, showing these follicles in different states. Primordial follicles, as you see, are much smaller. The growth in follicles as they go through the stages is enormous. This one's a primary follicle with an oocyte inside it, primary oocyte. Just pictures. But here, notice the large antrum, fluid-filled antrum that's emerged, which is what really defines this thing as a tertiary follicle compared to a secondary. Now let's go to 10 and look at the flowchart diagram of what's happening hormonally. The development of eggs in the ovary is controlled by a hormonal axis, namely the hypothalamus-pituitary-ovary axis. Those three parts are all endocrine structures. And so we've already learned about the hypothalamus producing gonadotropin-releasing hormone, right? Gonadotropin-releasing hormone, of course, stimulates the adenohypophysis into releasing the actual gonadotropins, which are luteinizing hormone and follicle-stimulating hormone. Well, now we see why luteinizing hormone is called that. It's called that because it produces the corpus luteum. How do you produce the corpus luteum? By getting rid of the oocyte by ovulation and leaving the rest behind. So luteinizing hormone is called that because that's the beginning of the corpus luteum, but the beginning of the corpus luteum coincides with ovulation. So luteinizing hormone, functionally speaking, is the major trigger, endocrine trigger, that causes ovulation. A spike in luteinizing hormone causes ovulation from the ovary. Well, before that happens, though, there has to be follicular development. And so follicle-stimulating hormone, released by the anterior pituitary, is what stimulates a certain 20 or so follicles to start developing as that cohort. That cohort or class, one of which will eventually graduate, will take several menstrual cycles or sexual cycles before graduation occurs. So it doesn't all happen in one cycle. It takes multiple cycles for the maturation of follicles. But by the time you get to the point where one of these tertiary follicles turns into a mature follicle and the rest of them die out, then it's ready for that class to actually have its graduating member ovulate. All right? Well, anyway, as follicle-stimulating hormone causes some number of follicles to develop, the granulosa cells that start multiplying, remember the granulosa cells, there are more and more of them in the follicle as it goes through the stages. Well, those granulosa cells are the cells that produce hormones in the follicle, and those the hormone produced by these granulosa cells, estradiol, the major estrogen, will feed back into this axis. All right, and therefore you get more and more release of follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. Gradually, though, because there's a gradual buildup of granulosa cells releasing more and more estrogen. When it hits a critical level, though, as we'll see, then that really causes a drastic peak in luteinizing hormone. And luteinizing hormone is the one particularly that causes the mature follicle to spit out its secondary oocyte at that point, which is what ovulation is, through the side of the ovary. Now, by the way, a secondary oocyte is secondary oocyte by virtue of the fact that it has completed meiosis I. There are two stages of meiosis, right? So a secondary oocyte is either going to die, in which case it never completes meiosis, and that's true for the vast majority of eggs in a woman's body, or it will be fertilized, and after fertilization is when meiosis actually finally gets completed, and if only then. So almost none of the eggs in a woman's ovaries ever complete meiosis, whereas in a male it's happening all the time. Now let's go to 11 and look at the sexual cycle, which actually contains two cycles in itself. The sexual cycle refers to what's happening in both the ovaries and the uterus. But what happens in these two different organs is, of course, different. So there, one part of the overall sexual cycle is the ovarian cycle, which is the top graph, the stuff that's happening in the ovaries and to the ovaries. Whereas the other part of the sexual cycle can be called either the menstrual cycle, or it could be called the uterine cycle as well, because that's what's happening to the uterus meanwhile. Now, like I said, the average for this whole series of events is 28 days, but it can be much shorter, and it can be especially much longer. So there's not only variability from individual to individual, but within a woman, there can be variation from cycle to cycle. So if it's 28 days right on the dot reliably, don't count on that always being true. It can change in your lifetime. Anyway, we have to number these days, and this is assuming a 28-day cycle. We have to number them, and just for convenience, we start numbering them day one as the first appearance of menstrual fluid discharge from the vagina. And that's simply because that's an easy thing that you can tell without looking in the inside of a woman. It's just obvious. So that's why we define that as day one. But really, that's in a sense toward the end of what's happening in terms of a sequence of events. Well, anyway, let's go up to the ovarian cycle and notice that the overall ovarian cycle is broken into the follicular phase and the luteal phase. Follicular phase occurring first. And the follicular phase is named, of course, for the maturation of the follicles. Now, the follicular phase goes up only to ovulation. It doesn't include anything after ovulation, because after ovulation, you no longer officially have any follicle, right? The follicle is only a follicle while the egg is still in it. So once that oocyte is released from the follicle, it's no longer called a follicle, therefore we're out of the follicular phase. But during the follicular phase, that's when you go through, you know, when a primordial follicle becomes primary first, then secondary, then tertiary, and then Graafian or mature. And notice above the pictures of the follicles what's happening hormonally. In blue we have follicle stimulating hormone, and notice that its secretion originally is what actually stimulates these primordial follicles into being chosen as members of the current cohort in order to develop into primary follicles originally. Luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone are fairly level throughout the follicular phase. But in the late follicular phase, notice that they both start to rise. And the reason that they both start to rise is because the estrogen that's being released by the granulosa cells triggers the anterior pituitary to release even more luteinizing and follicle-stimulating hormone, but especially luteinizing hormone, which is why it gets much higher in its peak. And the reason for that is simply because by then you have more and more granulosa cells. And the more cells you have producing estrogen, the more estrogen you have, so it's a stronger signal. The peak of the luteinizing hormone secretion is what actually brings about the ovulation, so that's what you see happening here in this mature follicle. And after that, luteinizing hormone drastically decreases, as does follicle stimulating hormone, but luteinizing hormone was really up there. So that is officially the creation of the corpus luteum, which is why luteinizing hormone has its name. And so the oocyte has already been ovulated at this point. The corpus luteum now is responsible for producing its hormonal product, which is progesterone, listed on the bottom. Bottom is the menstrual cycle or the uterine cycle, but progesterone comes from the corpus luteum. It affects, though, it has as its target tissue the uterus. Okay? Now, corpus luteum will live a certain amount of time. If pregnancy occurs, the corpus luteum will be allowed to remain alive longer and therefore keep producing its progesterone. The progesterone is required to keep the endometrial lining in the right shape for the developing embryo. So that's why the corpus luteum needs to continue to produce progesterone for a longer time than it normally would. Pregnancy doesn't occur, it just turns into useless material that we call a corpus albicans, because it turns whitish rather than yellow. Okay? But even a corpus luteum of pregnancy, as it's called, which lasts longer, still does not last long enough. It doesn't last throughout pregnancy. This is what I was saying before. Eventually it will die, and by then, though, the placenta is well enough developed that it can take over the job of progesterone secretion. All right, let's go down to the uterine cycle now, or menstrual cycle. Like I said, we just artificially name day one when we see blood and other material come from the vagina. But that really is toward the end of what's happening, because by this time, the uterus realizes there is no pregnancy, get rid of all this material, and start over in the next cycle. So we can see, this is a graph on the very bottom showing the thickness of the endometrium. And it thickens to prepare itself for pregnancy, but if that pregnancy hasn't occurred, then it starts to break down, and that eventually gets discharged from the vagina. That's day one. And it continues to be discharged for roughly 5 days on average. And what gets shed as menstrual fluid is the functional layer of the endometrium. I mentioned in a different lecture that the endometrial lining, or the endometrium, consists of two layers. The basal layer, which is always there, it's a thin layer of epithelium, And then the functional layer, which grows on top of the basal layer, which is not always there. That's the part that gets rebuilt and destroyed every 28 days on average in a non-pregnant woman. All right. So by the time menses, which is the period of menstruation, 5 days or so, by the time menses is done, you have nothing but the basal layer left, starting from scratch on the endometrium. Now it's time to build that up again. Okay. So there's the menstrual phase, which is also called menses. That's the very first part of the menstrual cycle or uterine cycle. That's followed by the proliferative phase. And what does proliferative mean? What does it mean to proliferate? To multiply. So both, notice that the building up of the lining is going to increase its size, of course. But it's increasing in size and thickness for two different reasons. First comes the proliferative phase. This buildup in the thickness is because cells are being added. They're proliferating. They're reproducing by mitosis. All right? So, the cells in the basal layer are spurred on during the proliferative phase to add new cells by mitosis. That's what creates the functional layer, the lighter pink, that adds the extra thickness originally to the endometrium. All right? And that lasts until about ovulation. Then you have even more thickness, but not because new cells are being added. In the secretory phase, which comes after the proliferative phase, most of the thickness is because the cells that are already there grow a little bit, and they start secreting a bunch of fluid, which is why this is called the secretory phase. And so their secretory products makes for thickness, and you know, it's not just water that they're secreting, it's a solution that's rich in nutrients. So this is really spurred on, the secretory phase, by progesterone. Progesterone really causes the secretory phase to occur in preparation for pregnancy, and that's why progesterone gets its name, right? Progesterone promotes gestation or pregnancy by preparing the uterine lining for implantation of a zygote first, which can then develop into an embryo. Well, success of that embryonic development relies on a nice, warm, moist environment that's full of nutrients. That's what the endometrial lining is. And the nutrients are there because of the secretion of these endometrial cells that have already proliferated a little bit earlier. All right? Well, that's only going to happen. Before I go on, I should say that as you add more cells to the thickness, you also need to add blood vessels to serve these cells. If they're going to remain alive, they have to have a blood supply. So there are arteries that build up in this functional layer, and they're called spiral arteries because of their shape. Well, they persist. They remain functional only if progesterone level is high enough, which it will be for a while because the corpus luteum is producing that progesterone. When the corpus luteum, though, has gone through its lifetime, you know, week, 10 days, whatever it is, depending on the woman, it will, of course, stop producing progesterone, which is what's responsible for the decline in the level here you see in the graph. Once it's below a critical level, then that will cause ischemia or narrowing of these spiral arteries in the endothelium. That cuts off the blood supply. When you cut off the blood supply, all the cells in that functional layer die. And so that creates basically the waste that used to be called the functional layer. Now it's just useless stuff, which collectively is the menstrual fluid to be released through the vagina starting the next cycle. But notice it starts dying before day one, because day one's defined as when it finally makes its way out of the vagina. This is still in the uterus at this point. All right. So really, if to number it based on what's trying to be accomplished here, day one would be right at the end of menses, right? But that's not how we number it. Okay, so let's go to 12. This is just a picture of actual ovulation through the wall of the ovary. As I said before, not only the oocyte, but also the cells that make up the cumulus oophorus get released from the ovary. And this ovary has, well, by the time you get the ovulation of this one, the graduating member of the cohort, the rest of those members of that cohort are just destroyed. But coming right behind them are several other cohorts, like juniors, sophomores, freshmen, for several different cycles worth, because it takes many cycles to actually go through all the maturation process. Those cohorts are behind. And in those cohorts, you don't know yet which one's going to be the chosen one to graduate. But eventually it will. One will be chosen. And as I told you earlier, in most women, you'll have ovulation from one ovary in one cycle, and then in the next cycle, I'm not sure how the signaling works to know it, but then the other ovary will do it the next time, and it just ping-pongs back and forth. Oh, meanwhile, by the way, remember there's no direct connection between the uterine tube or fallopian tube or oviduct with the ovary. So you can see the space between. But as ovulation is just about to happen, the uterine tube starts to prepare, expect that egg to be released, and it sets up, it pulses, and sets up currents in the peritoneal fluid, which will make it even more likely that if the egg is released in the right direction, it will kind of be swept in by the tide of the fluid into the infundibulum of the uterine tube. 13, well, I'm not going to read this to you because we've already described most of this stuff, but I included it because it's a good table to study in terms of what's happening in each of the stages. Now to 14, well, this is a picture of these spiral arteries I was talking about. So you have proliferative phase, secretory phase, menstrual phase. That's just three of the... That's three phases that occur one after another within the uterine cycle. But this is actually, instead of starting at day one, this is starting in order of how it really should be, right, in terms of preparing for pregnancy. So you prepare for pregnancy by starting with the just the basal layer of cells and then adding to it. That's what the proliferative phase is doing. Well, we see the spiral artery starting to develop. And you can see why they're called spiral arteries. The darker part is the basal layer. This is always there. But that's all you have at the very end of menstruation, just the basal layer. And then the rest of this, the functional layer, gets added on top of it. Not much secretion occurs there, though. This is all about just adding new cells because of mitosis. Once you have a great number of cells, which by itself adds thickness... Thickness is drastically increased beyond that when these cells that have already been created then start producing their fluid, which is rich in nutrients for an embryo that might exist. But assuming that doesn't happen and the body doesn't get the signal that there is a zygote there, then the death or the involution of the corpus luteum will spell the decline in progesterone levels, and it's that decline in progesterone levels that tells the uterus get rid of this functional layer. The spiral arteries narrow, that's the ischemia I was talking about, and that basically just suffocates everything, starves all these cells in the functional layer because they're not getting any nutrients or oxygen from the blood, and that's what produces the menstrual fluid, which then gets discharged. This is a drastic change in topics. So maybe it's a good place to just stop for the day. We can finish the chapter off the next time.